Well, good evening. If you will, open up your Old Testaments to Proverbs 23. We'll be there in a minute. Appreciate Brandon accommodating me. I told him that the lesson might be a little longer tonight, and so I appreciated him leading maybe one less song. So he was nice to do that. Maybe sometime he'll ask me the same favor. I want you to preach 10 minutes less, and so I will therefore feel obligated to do it, but only with Brandon. You know, the rest of you song leaders, don't get any ideas. The Proverbs have a lot to say. Obviously, they're written by most likely the idea of the princes. It's not that other people can't garner wisdom from it, but especially the first parts of Proverbs, you get the idea that it's the princes that are growing up and are going to have to lead Judah and Israel when they were united. And therefore, it's a father. It comes from father, mother, but basically the father instructing his son, and he's reminding him of these things. So a lot of the things that you encounter in this book are timeless in the sense that the same problems that young people face today, I guarantee you, without just saying there's fancier ways to do it and you can find other means that are more enhanced, I guess would be the way to say it. It's still the same thing. When you boil it down, you're still dealing with the same kinds of problems. Not everything in life, young people, has, and that's true for all of us. We need it, all of us. Not everything in life has a thou shalt not do this in front of it. I think you know that. But sometimes we think that if it doesn't have a thou shalt not in front of it, therefore it's a matter of judgment and we're allowed to do it. And while things are matters of judgment, doesn't mean that all things that are matters of judgment are good. There's bad judgment. We say that sometimes. There's good judgment. Bad judgment is not sin. It's not saying somebody has crossed that line in disobeying God. But here's the danger of it. You make enough bad judgments, or you make them continually in that area, and eventually they can lead to sin. Sometimes I try to ask myself this, and I ask it sometimes when I'm studying with young people. I say, the road that you're on, the road that you're walking, the things that you are doing, where does that road go? I mean, where do you look up with your eyes down life's road and say, where does my path eventuate in the end? I mean, where's this going to take me? Because you need to do that. Because not all judgments are good judgments, and bad judgments can have very bad consequences. I mean, there is no Bible verse that says, thou shalt not buy a motorcycle. I look. I just thought I'd bring that up. That includes skydiving, horseback riding, and snow skiing, for all of y'all that do the other. You can break your leg that way, too. There's no Bible verse that says, thou shalt not eat at Whataburger 5 times a week. But you understand that if you continually do that, you're going to have serious health issues sometime in your life. Whataburger is a good place to go. I go there occasionally, but not 5 times a week. There's no Bible verse that says, thou shalt not spend everything thou art paid from work. You understand that if you don't save, if you don't prepare for that rainy day, I know y'all think, it's so far out there. But you're going to be my age and you're going to be saying, man, I hope there's enough. And those are things that are going to come to every last one of us. And there's no sometimes, as we said, saying that this is sin. And so the subject that we're going to talk about tonight is that kind of subject. When we talk about drinking alcohol, we talk about what the Bible has to say about that. There's not a thou shalt not drink alcohol beverages of any kind. You're not going to find that verse. It's not in the Bible. It's not in the Old Testament or the New Testament. Now, that doesn't mean that, therefore, it's okay. It's just that we need to be honest and start where we need to start. And that is that the Bible doesn't come at this subject that way. In fact, folks, it may, while we understand the Bible warns against wine in places, let's just begin there in Proverbs 23 and at verse 29. You know this verse. He says, these verses. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who tarry long over wine. Those who go to try mixed wine. Do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things. Your heart utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. But when shall I awake? I must have another drink, as the English Standard renders it. Now, while we're all familiar with those verses, I suppose sometimes we fail on the preacher side of things to remember to say to everybody, but there's also Bible verses that commend wine. In Psalms 104, verse 15, it says of God, God did this, He's done this, He's done that. And in the midst of all of that, He says, God and wine, God has given this, and wine to gladden the heart of man. There's a passage in Ecclesiastes. How often do you come across this? Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. It is in life, He's just talking about what we all think about when we sit down over a meal, we eat and we drink, we have merriment with our friends, with our family. He's saying that there's nothing more really in life that you can get out of life if you realize that God has given you the ability to work and therefore to enjoy the things that you have. But then there are passages in Proverbs and that absolutely say some people shouldn't drink at all. In Proverbs 31, verse 4 and 5, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink. Those are different things we'll talk about later. Lest they drink, here's the reason why, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. And so, in almost an absolute way, it just says, it's not for kings, O Lemuel, to do this. We come to passages then in the New Testament that we saw some of that this morning. Your version may not render the qualification as I read it to you this morning in 1 Timothy 3:3 and Titus 1:7. It says that an overseer, the shepherd, the elder, is not to be a drunkard. Your version may say what the Greek almost literally says, not given too much wine. Well, that's an interesting thing. Why does he have the word much in there? Much is a comparative term. Much is composed of what? Not so much. Little. It's on the other end of the spectrum. In fact, that kind of phrase is found. Deacons say the same thing. Deacons likewise must be not addicted to much wine. Again, that comparative term, much, is there. Older women, Titus chapter 2, verse 3. Older women likewise are to be not slaves to much wine. I've left all the other things he says out just to get to the one that we want. You know that some Christians, and in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament times that were still part of the Old Testament, remember that John the Baptist was basically a Nazarite. What was a Nazarite not to do? Samson was this way. In fact, their mothers couldn't either. If they were babies, Nazarites from the time they were babies, they couldn't eat anything that came from the grape. They couldn't eat raisins. They couldn't eat fresh grapes. They couldn't drink anything that came from the grape. That was just one of the things that were a part of that vow. And so they were absolutely forbidden to do it. Some Christians, apparently, made the decision not to drink any wine. I mean, you can't get anything else out of what Paul says to Timothy than that idea. Timothy had made the decision that many of us have made. That is that we will not drink any. We are total abstainers. Timothy was that. 1 Timothy 5:23 says no longer. I mean, this is just a side note. These are letters written to people in their context. And here's a side note just about Timothy's health. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. And so Paul's advising him to use wine medicinally, to understand that it may help him in his stomach ailments. So again, I want you to think about those words much. When I grew up, the people that would preach these passages would eventually always say, this is saying total abstinence. And I used to think, I kind of cocked my head and I said, well then why is the word much there? I'm going to tell you, brethren, people are smarter than that. And we sometimes want to force an issue because we believe it's the right end where we ought to be. And I'm going to tell you in a minute, I'm going to get there. But I have to get there a far different way than the Bible saying, thou shalt not. I get there by the wisdom road. And that's a very different way. And it's another way that God approaches things. So But I want to tell you, isn't it interesting that he says to Timothy, a little? Take a little wine. Again, what? Comparatively to much. And so we need to understand that all through the Bible you run into this. There are two passages in the New Testament. The first one was one, and if you've never seen this, let me just tell you, the first time I saw it, all of my Church of Christ passed and everything within me kicked in. And I just thought, this cannot be. This can't be. Because I grew up in a total abstinent environment. I am a total abstainer, but again, for different reasons that I will tell you about as we get into the lesson. If we are honest with Scripture, sooner or later, you're going to come to Romans 14. I used the word much in a gospel meeting where I was. Some young people, I said something like, drink too much wine. Man, there was a young fellow met me at the back door. And so it commenced the chewing out. You know, I had preached false doctrine. We had gone blah, 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 on and on. I had to get up publicly during the gospel meeting to quiet things down for peace sake and say, I believe in total abstinence. By the statement I made, somebody could infer that I meant that, okay, yeah, you can go out and drink. And we're going to talk about all that in a minute. But what bothers me about brethren is there's a lack, I think, of being honest with the Scripture. And it's not just about this subject. It's the thing that Brother McCaslin was saying that the Pharisees can do, and folks, somehow we think we just skip over it. We don't do that. That doesn't happen to any of us. And it's just not looking at ourselves the way that we ought to look at ourselves. All right, Romans 14 is about what? Basically, it's about matters that are neither right nor wrong, but somebody believes they are right and wrong. Somebody believes that you can't, and there's only three things that are mentioned in this chapter. There's some people, Romans 14 verse 5, one person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. I want you to mark that last statement. Can you say that about the law of Almighty God? If God says, do not commit sexual immorality, is there some kind of leeway in there? If it seems right in your mind, go ahead and follow that. But if it doesn't seem right in your mind, go ahead and participate in sexual immorality. You see, you can't say that about something that God issues forth as law. You can only say, is it right in your own mind? Be convinced in your mind if it's a matter of judgment. If you can choose to honor a day, do you think he may be thinking of Jews that just could not? They're Jews. Can you imagine that when the first Jews obey the gospel, they don't quit observing the Sabbath. They don't quit observing all the feasts. Do you remember that statement about we're going to come to it in the life of Paul? He takes a vow. And he goes into the temple and cuts his hair and goes through all that the law of Moses said he had to do. First time I read that, I thought, wait a minute, wasn't the law of Moses nailed to the tree? What's going on here? Was he doing right? Was he doing wrong? No, he's a Jew. He didn't just pull the Jews up and yank them out of their society and thrust them over here into the Gentile world. What eventually would happen is the church would become way more Gentile. And lots of things would just go away, especially when the temple itself was destroyed. But you understand that may be what's going on here. One person esteems the Sabbath, another guy just says it's just another day. That may be what that might not be what he has in mind. But understand, days, what you eat, all right, that sounds really a lot like the Jews couldn't eat certain things. But the Gentiles obviously ate a lot of things that the Jews would consider wrong. One other thing he mentions. One other thing by name. We get into a lot of discussions about Romans 14 today. Here are three things that are named. He says in Romans 14, 21, it is good not to eat meat or drink wine or do anything that causes your brother to stumble. Stumble here is not just, you offended me. This is you fall over something that you're not going to get back up. The idea is that you have destroyed their faith. is the idea that can go in this. We have to be careful, even matters of judgment, we have to be careful what we do with other brothers and in their presence. And Paul says, I'll not do any of these things if it causes my brother's faith to fail. Look at one of the things he mentions. Drink wine. That's not grape juice, folks. You think that for a minute there's somebody offended because you drink unfermented grape juice? That you drink grape juice that has not turned yet because nothing's worked, no yeast have worked on the sugar and turned it into ethyl alcohol? That's not what he's saying here. You and I both know he's saying drink wine is in the category of judgment. First time I saw that, I said, well, dear God, I wish this passage was not in the Bible. I don't mean that to be sacrilegious in any way. It's just it went against everything I had ever been taught. Here's what you got to decide. You going to be honest with the Bible or your Church of Christism? You make your choice. You going to be honest with the Word of God and believe it because that's what's revealed? And now I've got to change my mind. I've got to understand where I've got to go with that. All right, there's another passage, Luke chapter 7, verse 33 and 34. Do you remember this passage? For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine. Some of the other passages, the Matthew passage says drinking, but Luke puts it very clear in there, drinking no wine. And this is Jesus speaking. And you say he has a demon. Remember, John the Baptist was a Nazarite. He couldn't touch any of that. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking. And you say, look at him, a glutton. The glutton's connected to what? Eating. And a drunkard. Connected to what? Drinking the wine. A friend of tax collectors and sinners. Do you see that? I'm going to tell you, what do you make of that passage? Because whatever you say about Jesus, you're going to have to say about John the Baptist part of it. If Jesus didn't mean this, then it's no more true of John the Baptist part of it either. And no, none of us deny John the Baptist part. We understand that he didn't eat bread or drink wine in that sense that, I mean, we know he ate grasshoppers with wild honey, which, honey, I commend to you, but not locusts. And the contrast is, he drank no wine, and the Pharisees saw it, and they said, you're that. They looked over at Jesus and saw Jesus. Now, whatever you make John, you're going to have to do with Jesus. The opposite. And then you've got to do something with the word drunkard. Some people say, well, the Pharisees just made all that up. No, if they made it up about Jesus, they made it up about John the Baptist, too. Because there's your contrast. I'm going to tell you, when you come to these passages for the first time, it's unnerving. Any of y'all unnerved by this? I mean, anybody? Okay, good. Most of them were my age and have gray hair. But I want you to understand it's okay to be unnerved. Jesus unnerves us all the time, if we're honest. We come to the Word of God, and he makes us understand that there are some things we have to think our way through. Now, how do we apply these passages? First, be fair and honest with the biblical text. Be fair and honest with the biblical text. What absolutely gives brethren no credibility is if they come saying the Bible commands absolute abstinence. That's what not giving too much wine means. Total abstinence. That's what I grew up with. Now, I'll tell you, these young people are smarter than that. And there have been for a long time. And you lose all credibility with an informed hearer if you do something like that. That's not how we're going to get there. Understand, I'm a total abstainer. I'm going to get there. But I get there through wisdom, not through absolute commands. Now, here's where I want you to pay close attention. And these, I know, are being sent out to everybody. And I want, like his own, to hear this. Brother Durham They said, okay, so Brother Durham says we can go drink socially, we can have it in our homes, we can go to bars and drink, just don't get drunk. No, Brother Durham believes in total abstinence. But I get there in a different path. But I want you to know that from the beginning. Because sometimes, folks, when I preach stuff like this, I go home and I can't sleep that night. Not because I doubt what I have done. I just know what brethren out there are capable of doing to me. I know why they can hurl all kinds of things to you. And I realize that even if you preach it here, and I asked my brother Dawson to not necessarily put it up on the website, but make it available to anybody who's a member here, there are reasons for that. Not because I'm ashamed of this, but I'm going to tell you, brethren misbehave badly. And you pay for it for months and years to come. Not because it's not the truth. Because there are too many people who are wedded to Church of Christ doctrine and not to what the Word of God says. We must compare, and we've got to start here, apples to apples and oranges to oranges. Not apples to oranges. I should have brought two pieces of fruit to really make that point. You've heard that phrase, you know. And that's what is true about Bible times of drinking alcoholic beverages compared to today. Let me illustrate it first this way. The Bible was not written to us, but for us. Brother Horton used to tell me that. I used to walk with him and learn from him as he would teach. And I can still hear him say that to me. He would look at his New Testament that he had, one of those old American Standard New Testaments that's hardback, and he would say, the Bible is not written to us, it was written for us. What do you mean by that? He meant it's a historical document. What we read in here has context that is historically determined sometimes. We read about shepherds and guys going through the field sowing their seed, and we read about wineskins, and we read about all kinds of things that you go, well, what is this? What does that mean with the wineskin burst? And he uses this, you know, this teaching and illustration from that. It's because he didn't have to explain that part of it to the world he was in. That part of the world he was in saw that every day. They lived it because it was written and spoken to them. But it was spoken for us as it was spoken for all people who will ever live. Let me give you an example. Four times in the New Testament. 2 Corinthians 13:12 is the shortest of them. Greet one another. Remember when we did the one another passages? I should have put that one in there. Greet one another with a holy kiss. Now folks, if I took that literally, if I believed that that's what I had to do to please God, then I'd just march up to John Albert. I told him I was going to use him tonight, and so he's just been on needles. And I'd grab old John Albert and I'd kiss him real big, slurpy old kiss right there on his cheek. And I'd never make it to the other cheek. Not at all. If I tried to do that to one of the guys in this congregation, All right, are we disobeying God? There it is. Plain command. Plain as plain can get. We watch guys in the, you know, y'all remember Yasser Arafat? I know none of y'all do over here, but you remember Yasser Arafat? And every time you'd watch him on TV, or any of those guys in the Middle East, they'd take a guy and bust him on this side, and they'd bust on that side. You know, I know my friends in China, they go to China and they say you're standing on a corner and a grown man, you're with your brothers in Christ, a grown man reaches over and grabs your hand and everybody holds hands as they cross the street. You know, first time you encounter that as a Westerner, you're kind of like going, these are really weirdos, but it's their culture. All right, it's written in a historical context. Paul wouldn't have said, greet one another with a holy handshake. Because that's not how they greeted each other. So what are we supposed to do with that? I'm going to tell you, we have to do something with it. Are we commanded to change our form of greeting in our culture and now we need to go up to John Albert, all of y'all do afterward, and kiss him on both cheeks? Or do we understand this passage in a historical context and from it we're going to make judgments, folks. We all make judgments about the Bible. What do we apply? How do we apply it? And the judgment we have made about this passage is greet one another in holiness no matter what form it takes in your culture. Because how would you reach people with the Word of God if you started going up on campus and kissing the guys on both cheeks? You can see how far that would go. All right. There are lots of things like that. Robert Stein, there's an article that is going to be sent to you along with the... And don't get dismayed, you know, we're sending out the PowerPoints. But this is an article I've done many times here before, Wine Drinking in New Testament Times. I think Ross was who got this for me also. There's another great article in the back that is attached to this. So there's two articles, and the one that's in the back is written by Norman Geisler called A Christian Perspective on Wine Drinking. Okay, you're going to get both of these in PDFs, but you can pick up the hard copy if you're old-fashioned like me and you want to read it on paper. Now here's what Robert Stein says when he starts his article. If we do not seek first to understand what the text meant when it was written, it will be very difficult to interpret intelligently what it means. That should be it. What it means and demands of us today. Do you see that? That's just simple, common logic, isn't it? And that's exactly what we need to apply to this passage. All right. So wine drinking in New Testament times is not equal to consumption of alcoholic beverages in 21st century America. Why? Why is that? I'm going to tell you, he does an outstanding job, and so does Norman Geisler. I've heard Norman Geisler speak in person, and he's very, very knowledgeable and very, very adept. But here's what Stein says. Y'all don't have this in your handout because I figured you'd get the... I didn't want to waste more paper printing all this off. It's in the packet. My subject here is the use of the term wine in the New Testament. Some reader may already be thinking, is he going to try to tell us that wine in the Bible means grape juice? Is he going to try to say that the wine mentioned in the New Testament is any different from the wine bottled today by Christian brothers or Chateau Lafite? Is that how you say that? Rothschild or Mogan David? Well, my answers are no and yes. No, the wine of the Bible was not unfermented grape juice. Yes, it was different from the wine of today. He goes on to say, this is how you know what goes on. In fact, you can see this, especially if you go to Greece or you go to some place among the Greeks, among the Romans, and among the Jews. It was all common. In ancient times, wine was usually stored in large pointed jugs. They usually were very tall. In fact, when it says that's what they brought, you remember in the John 2 passage, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about those big jugs. The wine would be in that, stored in large pointed jugs called amphorae. When wine was to be used, it was poured from the amphorae into large bowls. And you'll find these bowls, they're just humongous. They're not very deep, they're something like that, but they're really big. They were called craters, where it was mixed with water. And that's the thing you're going to find out in the evidence that Stein marshals and everybody else marshals is, if you understand what happens in the ancient time, they took straight wine that was made and fermented out of those tall jars, poured it into the crotchers, and mixed it with water, usually 3 parts water to 1 part wine, but it could be all kinds of different ratios, but that's the common, most common that you read. Where it was mixed with water, from these crotchers, cups or kyliks that they would drink from, then were filled. What is important for us to note is that before wine was drunk, it was mixed with water. The kylix were filled not from the amphorae, but from the crotchers. And those things you can see all through museums if you like that sort of thing and want to see it. Drinking wine unmixed, he goes on to say, was looked upon as a Scythian or barbarian custom. You might say here in College Station, that's what Red Raiders do. Or LSU people. Scythians. Barbarians. Those were the worst people. Folks, and we're going to make that point later. These were pagans who say this. These were pagan unbelievers who believed this. If you drank wine straight out of the amphorae, if you didn't mix it with water, you were a Scythian, a barbarian. The ratio of water might vary, but only barbarians drank it unmixed, and a mixture of wine and water of equal parts was seen as strong drink and frowned upon. The term wine or oinos in the ancient world then did not mean wine as we understand it today, but wine mixed with water. Again, he marshals evidence. You can read it for yourself. Norman Geisler, I only have one quote from him from the one I mentioned to you that's at the back of the packet. Though fermented wine was drunk in Bible times, and though the Bible approved of wine drinking, as we have looked at, one needs to remember that the alcoholic content was much less than that of wine today. What is used today is not the wine of the New Testament. Therefore, Christians ought not to drink wine, beer, or other alcoholic beverages. He's going to make his conclusion. For they are actually strong drink and are forbidden in Scripture. Even ancient pagans did not drink what some Christians drink today. The part that I found fascinating about that was his last statement. Even ancient pagans did not drink what some Christians drink today. Now folks, what would God say to us? I don't know. I don't know what He would say if He were in our time exactly, but I have a sneaky suspicion, don't you? That if His warnings come in an environment that always drank it mixed with water, well watered down, in fact. Stein says, two martinis, and I don't even know what's in there, vodka and whatever else, maybe it's straight vodka. Two martinis would equal 22 glasses of the same size, content of the same size, mixed 3-1. You'd have to drink that much. And as he says, your bladder would be affected long before your mind if you drank that much. Now, it's not that they couldn't get drunk, and it's not that they didn't drink it straight. It's not that some pagans misbehaved. All of that, I think, is brought out in some of the things that you read in the times, but we need to think about that. All right, putting it into context, let's think about facts, because facts are what they are. All of these quotes that we're going to look at now come from Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Drunk driving costs the United States annually $132 billion. Do you have an idea of how much that is? Think about how many wrecks, how many wasted lives, how many loss of productivity, fetal alcohol syndrome, liver damage. You know, you just go down the line. Each day, 27 people are killed by drunk drivers. You ever thought about that? You ever go down the road and you see those crosses on the side of the road where somebody died and people still come and put flowers there? How many of those you think were caused by drunk drivers? Or it was a drunk driver? We're going to look at that in a minute. But if you had a disease that was killing Americans at the rate of 27 people every day, I'm going to tell you, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta would be greatly alarmed. But we do it every day because everybody turns a blind eye to alcohol. We've already gone through our prohibition time. We've already tried that nationally, and it didn't work on the national scale, and so it was all brought back, and everybody ignores it. But if the Zika virus was killing people at the rate of 27 people today, what do you think would happen at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta? Over 40% of all 10th graders drink alcohol in the United States. Fatalities and auto crashes due to alcohol, the highest percentage, if you're 21 to 24, 30% of all fatalities occur in that age group. But 25 to 29 are close behind it, 29. If you add those together, almost 60% of all the drunk driving fatalities are caused by people who are ages 21 to 29. You think of why your insurance rates are so high, especially you guys. Every 2 minutes, someone is injured in a drunk driving auto crash. I already looked at how many are killed. Somebody is injured every 2 minutes. There's a quote that John Adams, who was the second president of the United States, made. He defended, I don't know if y'all know this, but in the Boston, what's called the Boston Massacre on our side, when the British opened fire and killed 7 of the colonials in Boston, part of the process that started the revolution. Of all people, John Adams defended the soldiers. He defended the British soldiers. Because when he got up, they had been the crowd had been hurling oyster shells and everything else they could get at the crowd. And I mean, you had these few British soldiers being surrounded by a mob, and it didn't take long for that to heat up. And in fact, he got every last one of them off because they were so worried about what it would do to his reputation. But here's one of the things he said when he talked about what you have to do with truth. He said, facts are stubborn things. Facts are stubborn things. They don't go away. When you look at that list of what's on there, what do you think? I was in a courtroom. I would have been seated. I think I've told you all this before. I would have been seated on the jury. I was really looking forward to it. I've never been on a jury before. I don't usually let preachers get on juries, but man, I was number 9. I'm on. Except the guy comes down, you know, and starts talking to me. It was an alcohol case. The guy was already behind bars. He had driven away from an establishment, and he had run head-on into girls that were 3, head-on down the road. Didn't kill them, but man, injured one of them horribly. She'd had all kinds of medical problems and surgeries and blah, blah, blah. There's a law in the state of Texas that if a man lets you walk out of his establishment that he owns and you're drunk, you can sue him. You can sue the establishment. That's what this case was about. And so somewhere in there I mentioned that alcohol is a drug. And I remember that other guy writing down real fast, you know. And he said, well, it may be a drug, Mr. Durham, but it's a legal drug. We're going to look at that in a minute. It still affects you. It still affects you. Because it's exactly that. It's a drug. Facts are stubborn things. The reason all of this happens. When there were 30 people behind me, or 30 of us all total, you should have listened. I told that guy, I said, have you really listened to one word these people have said behind you? It was my time to rant and rave on a lawyer. I said, have you listened to these people? One person said, I'm divorced because I was married to a drunk. Another guy said, I had a friend changing a flat tire and a drunk ran by and killed him. Another person said, I'm divorced because I was drunk. My dad was an alcoholic and I hate the stuff. I mean, these are all the things I'm hearing behind me. I said, do you hear this? Do you hear any of it? Facts are stubborn things. So what is beverage alcohol? Well, I had to take a 2-day motorcycle safety foundation basic rider course. Okay, go ahead and laugh. The state of Texas requires it. You have to take it. It's good. I might be dead if I hadn't taken it, okay? So think about that. All right, here's what they tell you in that section that you have to think about alcohol. 60% of motorcycle accidents, by the way, fatalities, where they were drunk. Depressant drugs such as alcohol, you see the word drug? Slow down bodily functions. Alcohol enters the bloodstream quickly with the effects beginning after the first drink. The primary effects of alcohol are to diminish visual capabilities for which they are concerned and alter good judgment for which I am concerned. But that's one of the first things that happens when you begin to drink alcohol. The more alcohol there is in the blood, the greater the degree of impairment. The adult male body is able to eliminate alcohol at the rate of almost one drink per hour. Women process alcohol at about 3/4 of that rate. If a person drinks at a rate faster than his or her body can eliminate it, the alcohol begins to accumulate in the bloodstream. And at a blood alcohol concentration of approximately 0.05%, most people are impaired. This is a course that is required in not just the state of Texas, but they've been in business since 1973, this international agency that monitors all this. There are many, many states that this is exactly what they read. The last quote from that book. People who try to control their blood alcohol content in their blood usually don't have much success because judgment is one of the first faculties to be impaired. Because impairment can occur long before a person reaches the legal limit, it is better to separate drinking from riding, period. Now that's what they said in that book. You can read, you can study, you can do everything you want to, but you're still going to come down to the fact that it is a depressant drug, and it begins to alter judgment, and it does a lot of other things. So what should we do with this info? Since judgment is the first thing altered by alcoholic consumption, what do we do with the Bible's frequent admonitions? And it's not meaning sober, folks. When it says sober, I'm not using it as you're drunk. But isn't that interesting that we do in English? If you're drunk or sober, they're the opposites. But the Bible's frequent admonition to be sober-minded and self-controlled. How many times? 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 6, so then let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. 2 Timothy 4 5, as for you, always be sober-minded. Galatians 5, 22, 23, you know, say the fruit of the Spirit, one of the things is self-control. And then Titus, he writes in chapter 2, Paul does 11 and 12 to him, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live, the first thing he says, self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age. And folks, that's just a sample. Now, if alcohol is a depressant drug that alters my judgment almost immediately when I take it, what do I do with these passages? Why would I want to take anything that alters my mind from being sober-minded, from being self-controlled? Does that make sense? Since drunkenness is sin, there's no doubt about that. Everybody knows that. Obviously, we make the point, if we never drink, we'll never face the altered judgment that gets us drunk and sins. We make the judgment, right? I get there, different path, but I get to total abstinence by making one argument after another in my mind to what I think God would want me to do in this culture and how people drink here. You don't think the pagans, if they called people that mixed the wine drink, didn't mix wine in that day, Scythians and barbarians, what would they call Americans? What would they call Americans? Where exactly is God's line of impairment that finally gets to drunkenness? Nobody knows. I had somebody preach here not long ago that suggested that line, but nobody knows. Do you know? Is it man's line of what's drunk? I think we can see a falling down drunk. Is that what he means when he says it? Just staggering everywhere, you know, speech is slurred, he can't. Or is it somewhere back of that? Because folks, whatever the line is, when you cross it, you sin against God. So are you so certain about the line that you've drawn in your mind? Is it that falling down, staggering, slurred speech? Is it the legal limit of, you think God cares about that? But where is God's line? I'm going to tell you what he says, 1 Corinthians 5:11. But now I'm writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of a brother if he is guilty of, and one of the things he lists is drunkard. No, not even to eat with such a one. Could it be that we like to drink alcohol? We like the buzz it gives us? Sort of rings a passage that says, the passing pleasures of sin. Things that appeal to us in this world. Is it for friend's sake? No, the passage it says, as you do, evil companions can corrupt good morals. I'm going to tell you, there have been a lot of people go down a terrible path and end up in jail, end up killing people in auto crashes, and all because they were running with the wrong bunch and drinking and smoking dope and doing all kinds of stuff. Or is it that we want to live as close to the edge as we possibly can? Nobody can tell me I'm sinning. No, not really. But did anybody listen to anything that was said to us last weekend about what a Christian should be like? Those guys teaching us said some really valuable things. So what I'm concerned tonight with, finally to get there, is why do you choose to go to bars? The reason for this lesson is that I have had three young people among you come to me in the last 6 weeks, maybe a little more. First one came, said, I'm worried. No people are going to bars. I'm going to talk about that more later. I'm worried about them. I'm concerned. Would you preach a lesson about it? So, okay, I tuck it away. Then a few weeks go by and another guy comes. Then a few weeks more, another says, hey, you got anything? I'm studying with somebody. Folks, when there's that much fire, I mean smoke, there's fire. So if you're not here tonight and you're listening to Chuckles preach about alcohol and about bars, will you listen to me? Will you, if you disagree with me, do you know who I am? You know how much I love you. Please listen. Just listen. That's all I'm asking you to do. And then think about it later. Why do you go to the bar scene? What would Jesus do? WWJD. Everybody had it on their bands. Don't wear them as much anymore. Good question. It's a great question. Somebody might ask a question, well, would he have gone to bars? Would he have gone to a bar? He frequently ate with some pretty bad people. He ate with tax collectors and sinners. And I'm going to tell you, among that bunch, they were prostitutes. That gets pretty bad. Nobody liked tax collectors because they were Roman traitors to the Romans. Somebody says, well, would Jesus have gone to a bar? I don't know. But I have a sneaky suspicion that he probably would have if he ate with tax collectors and sinners. So why would Jesus have gone to that place? Would it have been to enjoy the music? Well, possibly he went to a wedding once. He wasn't some kind of austere guy that lived out in the desert like John the Baptist. You remember that deal? John the Baptist doesn't. Jesus does. He must have gone to parties. Did he go there maybe for the camaraderie of convivial friendship? Do you like that phrase? I made that up. Would Jesus have imbibed from the selection at the bar? No, not based on what I know from what we've studied so far. Not in this culture. Here's a good reason for what Jesus would have done if he'd have gone to a bar. The scribes and the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners? And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. You know why Jesus would have gone into a bar? I go where sick people are. But that's what he would say for an AM football game. And that's what he would say for a wedding. I go where sick people are. I came to call the righteous and the sinners. So if that's true of Jesus, what's my reason? Is my reason to go to a bar Jesus' reason? I mean, how many, let me ask you something about that. How many from those bars have I brought to the Lord? Because I guarantee you that's why Jesus would be there. It may be that the music would have pleasantness to it. It may be that you could eat food. And it may be that lots of things like that would go on. But I'm going to tell you, He's going to be there for one reason. To bring as many people as He can to the Lord. So what's your reason for going to the bar? Is it the drink? Is it the friends? Is it the dancing? What's your reason? You're on that road. Why are you on that road? And where are you going on that road? Do you know that God judges the local church for actions that we commit? Let me back up or black it out for a minute. Those three people that came to me, I thought about 1 Corinthians 1:11, for it has been reported to me by Chloe's people that there is quarreling among you, my brothers. Paul didn't chastise Chloe's people. They weren't gossiping. They loved their brothers. And they didn't know what to do but to come to the Apostle Paul. Huge concern for their salvation. I'm going to tell you, that's why those three young people came to me. It wasn't just about going to bars and drinking and dancing. Some of their concern is engaging in sexual immorality and as if it's nothing. And so the first thing I told them, and I want you to understand this, I told all three of them this. You have a responsibility before God to go directly to the people that you know. And if you're worried about how it will be received, take others with you that may know. But go. Do your part. I'll do mine. I'll preach on this. So if you get angry at them because they come to you, or they come to you now because they're pricked in their conscience to do that, I'm going to tell you right now, who has the stinking attitude? You know that we are to watch out for one another and how easily we all are beset by sin. Now to what I said here. Did you know that God judges the local church for your actions, whether the rest of us know it or not? You ever thought about that? I used to hate in school when we would pay for somebody talking in the back and she'd made all of us write. 1,000 times I'll keep my mouth shut in Mrs. So-and-so's class. But in Joshua, the 7th chapter, verse 10, the Lord said to Joshua, when they didn't understand, now they had defeated Jericho, now they've been defeated before Ai, and they're in the enemy's territory, and they're going to be slaughtered is what they're thinking. So they're all mourning and praying before God. And the Lord said to Joshua, get up. Why have you fallen on your face? Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen and lied. And Joshua, you're one of them. I don't like that. That sounds like Mrs. So-and-so's class that may be right 1,000 times. But I'm going to tell you what. You want to argue with God? God may judge this local church because within our midst are people doing things they ought not to do, and those of us that do know are doing nothing about it. In 1 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, in verse 6, these people did know about it. Your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? So if you are doing these things, why are you doing these things? Would your parents be proud of you if they found out? Would they be proud of you if they knew? Would the elders at Twin City, if they find out? Would your adoptive parents? Someday they see you doing that. You know the reason why. I don't have to spell that out. But what if when you are there drinking at a bar, at that moment, the very moment that you're there, the trumpet that all will hear, no matter where they live on this earth, you hear it. The moment that you're having illicit sexual relationship with your boyfriend or girlfriend, at that moment, you hear the trumpet blow. We could list a lot of things. What would happen to us? I don't get to total abstinence because there's a Bible passage that says don't do it. I get there because it's just not a wise thing to do. It's not where we ought to be. It doesn't lead us to the right end. And that's why I behave the way I do. May not be enough for you, but I hope you'll think about what I've said and dwell on it. Your subject to heaven's invitation. Thank you. I know we have gone long over, but thank you for listening so patiently. If your subject to heaven's